Yeah, when JP messaged me about the opportunity to be here tonight, of course I was excited to be here. He did text me back and tell me the parameters of the time frame. He gave me initially a 50-minute time frame, and then he told me that 50 minutes was going to be more like an hour, about 60 minutes worth, and I was like, wow. My home congregation gives me, if I'm lucky, 25 to 30. So we've prepared for as much as possible this evening. Esther is a wonderful book full of information and background that teaches a wonderful lesson. By way of introduction, of course, we're going to be looking at Esther and the idea of courage this evening. But when you look at the teachings of Jesus throughout the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you see immediately the value that Jesus places on women. When you look at society and the legal system throughout the Old Testament world and into the world in which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John would have been writing, you will see that women were given a much lesser value and a much lesser role in society and in the legal system. For example, when you read of the resurrection account of Jesus at the end of the four Gospels, you'll notice the first people to give witness and testimony to the resurrected Christ were women. In the ancient Roman world, women would not have been allowed to testify in court based on the fact, the simple fact, that they were women. But yet, in the account of Jesus' resurrection, the first account, the first people to give an account of his resurrection that was given credence was that of women. When you look at the birth of Jesus as given by Matthew, no less than five women are mentioned within his genealogical account. We see that Jesus does indeed value people. When you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and you read verses 26 and 27, you'll read that, and God said, let us create man, that word there meaning humans. Let's create people in our image and our likeness. In verse 27, so he created both male and female. God created them in his image. Just like men, women are made in the image and likeness of God. And they are given the same amount of credence and access to salvation as men are. For in Christ there's neither male nor female. For all have access. Which brings us to Esther and the idea of courage. Now, for many, at least academically speaking or mentally speaking, we ascribe courage to mean, for whatever reason, the lack of fear. And when in reality and in practicality, courage simply means being brave enough to do the right thing even when you're full of fear. Even when you are scared to death to do it, you still do what is right. When you think of the most courageous people you've ever come across, and if you've come across any interviews that they've done, not a one of them will tell you they were without fear. Quite the opposite. They'll tell you they were quite fearful, and yet they did what they knew was right. This evening we will look at a young lady by the name of Esther. Her Hebrew name would be Hadassah. She is an orphan girl. Her mother and father had died. And she was seen after and she was looked after by her cousin Mordecai. He took her as her own daughter, raised her, took care of her. As her next of kin, kinsman and redeemer, he was the one who would have raised her and took care of her during that time. And in chapter 1 of Esther we see that we are in a time of Ahasuerus, which his Greek name would have been, we're probably more familiar with, that of Xerxes. And we see that he has, in this book, the writer of this book, of Esther, begins in the days of Ahasuerus. The Ahasuerus, who reigns from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now, if you have read the historical accuracy of Ezra, the Persian kingship that was there, it was mentioned, and I'm trying to find my source and my eyes are not locking in on it just yet here. Herodotus wrote that there were only 20 provinces or 20 political divisions. Likely what the author of Esther is referring to here would be what we would refer to as metro statistical areas, the metropolitan area of a city and its surrounding areas. But this is a territory that would stretch from Ethiopia in Africa to India, to the Indian subcontinent and South Asia, spanning three continents, that of Africa, Asia, and Europe. He sat on his royal throne, which was the citadel in Susa. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all of his princes in attendance, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. My first question as I read this would be, why is he giving this banquet? There's always a why. I know at times when we have small children, typically the one word they lock on to very quickly is the word why. It's time to eat. Why? It's time to take a nap. Why? You know, they lock on that pretty quick. Rebecca and I have four boys ranging in age from almost 2 up to 9, and we've heard that question many times. Why? And there's times we ourselves will ask that question. Why? So why is he doing this? This section sets the tone for the book. The vast wealth, splendor, and glory of Ahasuerus' majesty draws attention to his lavish banquets at Susa, where he is gathering support and loyalty for his military campaign against Greece. The irony of this picture will be lost, or is lost on us today. As for me, I enjoy looking at not only the biblical background, but the historical background of what's going on here. Here's the ironic part. The original readers of this book would have known that 4 years after this particular banquet, Ahasuerus or Xerxes would return virtually broke and broken from his ill-advised attack on Greece. Now, given that the author of Esther is writing years after Ahasuerus' defeat, he could have chosen to introduce him as a Persian king who lost the epic battle at Hellespont to the Greeks. Instead, he chooses to introduce Ahasuerus in the grandeur and the confidence at the height of his glory. The unstated reversal of the king's destiny, which would have been known to the author and the original readers, sets the stage and foreshadows other reversals of fortune throughout the book of Esther. One of the main ones being that Esther, the girl who was an orphan, who relied on an older cousin to be her support, to basically be her parent, going from an orphan child to queen of the most dominant empire in the world at that time. If that's not a reversal of fortune, folks, I don't know what is. But we see to begin with, we see it's in the days, or it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. We see here the linguistic formula that is set up. It's found in other books in the Old Testament, Joshua, Judges, Samuel. His story continues what had gone on beforehand. It can also be used in the beginning of a narrative, as in Ruth 1. The author introduces the book in such a way to suggest to his readers that the ensuing story are events that have actually happened. So we see here that the king, Ahasuerus, or the Greeks would know him as Xerxes, he's planning an attack on Greece. He brings in all the people of any power and might in his kingdom, the noble people, the nobles, the provinces, the princes and nobles of the provinces, being his president. He displays his riches, his royal glory, the splendor of his great majesty, verse 4, for many days, specifically 180. To do the quick math, that's basically 6 months. He spends showing off his glory. Why is he doing that? He's having the banquet to bring in the nobles and the princes and the governors there. He's showing them his glory so he can win their support. We understand that any military leader worth his salt, if he is to win battles and win wars, he must have the support of those around him and those going to war. He has to have that support. So he's showing what he has to offer to those who would go fight for him in such a way as to win. We see that in verse 5, those days were completed and over. The king gave a banquet lasting for 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa for another week, from the greatest to the least, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. This is open to everyone. For the higher-ups, those who were nobles and princes and governors, they got 6 months. Everybody, the greatest of the least, got a week. So we see that everyone is included in some way or another. We see in verse 7, this comes to play a little bit later, that drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds. The royal wine was plentiful according to the king's bounty. The drinking was done according to law. There was no compulsion. For so the king had given orders to each official of his household that he should do according to the desires of each person. we see in verse 9, Queen Vashti, his wife, also gives a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. We understand from this that while the men dined in one place, the women dined in a separate place. They feasted separately, as was the custom not only of Persia, but basically the entire ancient world. So we see in verse 10, on the seventh day, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, that's a fancy way of simply saying he's drunk. He commanded 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring the queen before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and to the princes, for she was beautiful. He basically wanted to display her. Much like we would display a beautiful piece of jewelry or a family heirloom, something that would be very valuable to us, he's basically wanting to put his wife on display. Not as his wife, but basically as a possession. Is what he's wanting to do. Put on your crown and your best clothes, you're beautiful, I want to show you off. Not as my wife, but basically as a possession and an object. And as with most women, she, verse 12, refused the king's command. And we see at the end of verse 12, the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. Now remember, his judgment is clouded by his drinking. His wife, the queen, has just told him no. And being one who is not of sound judgment, he's about to make a worse judgment. In anger and while imbibed. The king said to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king, so to speak, before all who knew law and justice and were close to him, the 7 princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom, according to law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not obey the command of the king delivered by the eunuchs? In the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan tells him, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that the queen had not only wronged the king, but also the princes and all the people who are in the provinces. Verse 17 tells us, for the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husband, by saying, the queen didn't have to obey the king, so we don't have to obey you. This was his advice to the king. So verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, that is the king, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of the king, and let the king give a royal position to another who is more worthy than she. So we see here the advice he gets from his advisors. At least with King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes here, at least he goes to his advisors. When we look at those in authority and those who are in positions of power, those who typically rule well will have those who can offer sound advice. And there is much truth in that. When you read Solomon in the Proverbs, you'll see time and again that in the wealth of counselors, great decisions are made. We understand that when we decide to do something that's important and that's major in our lives, whether it's we're getting married or we're preparing for, say, retirement, we get those who can advise us best on our particular situation. We seek those who are knowledgeable and those who have first-hand experience in what particular field we're looking for. If, for instance, you're wanting to save for retirement or save to buy a home, you don't want advice from someone who is financially broke. You're looking to be the opposite of that. You want someone who's been successful, who's done that, been there, done that. So at least for Ahasuerus here, at least he's seeking advice. Now the advice he gets may not be the most sound advice as far as from a human relationship situation, but from a legal situation, one can see the advantage of the advice he's given, unfortunately. So we see in verse 21, this pleases the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every person according to their language, that every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. So we see Queen Vashti, because she was not not willing to be made an object and a possession of the king, she is deposed by the king. She is let go. In his anger, we would say he divorced her. So we see in chapter 2, as chapter 2 begins, verses 1 through 7, the king sends out letters again into all the kingdom, all the provinces, all the cities, that women should be brought to the capital city of Susa, and that he would pick a queen from those brought to him. Excuse me. So, basically, there's about to be a beauty pageant to be undertaken. More or less, that he's going to bring in all these women, and he's going to pick the prettiest one. Now, verses 5 and following, we find that there's at the citadel, at the capitol building in Susa, a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah would have been her Hebrew name. Esther would have been her Greek name. And we see here that he's bringing her up, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the command goes out, he brings her up. Verse 4 says, when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months were the regulations for the women, so on and so forth, they would come in, he would take a look at them, leave. Verse 15, Esther's turn. She goes in, and we see that verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she found favor and kindness with him more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen. Two things quickly that the king is not aware of yet. One is not going to make much of a difference, but one is going to make a major difference. Number one, this is a girl who has no training in royalty whatsoever. Matter of fact, she has no parents anymore. She's being raised by a cousin. Both verses 10 and 20 tell us that Esther does not make known her lineage, her background. She's Jewish. She doesn't make that known. Mordecai, we find in both verses 10 and 20 of chapter 2 that it was at the behest of Mordecai that she doesn't make that known. Now, the fact that she was an orphan, that she was not of royalty, typically when princes married, they looked for someone, other princesses or someone else with royal blood. They tend to look for someone of that nature. The king here is about to marry a girl who has none of that, and it seems it doesn't matter. He basically needs a pretty face who will basically go along with what he has to say, and he finds that, at least he thinks so, in Esther. But what he doesn't know, and there's times we must understand what we don't know, can indeed hurt us. Now, this doesn't hurt the king, but we're going to find another gentleman coming along here in just a minute that it's going to be a huge problem for. So she's a Jew, but the king is not fully aware of it. She is made queen. Verses 17 through 20. We see in verses 21 through 23, the end of chapter 2, we're given an account of an event that happens that as you're reading this, it seems like it's almost told in passing. It's like you're having a conversation with a friend at lunch or something, and you just throw in something, you say something kind of offhand, it kind of doesn't have anything to do with what's being said, it's just added in. And that seems to be what's here, but yet this does come back to play. If you watch TV a lot, yeah, if you watch any type of series, TV series or something of that sort, you're watching it, you're following the storyline, a situation happens, when it happens you really don't notice it, it just goes through until something happens later in the episode, or maybe even an episode or two later, like, oh, wait a minute, that's what that meant, I got it. So in verses 21, 22, and 23, this is one of those, oh, by the way, this happened. And what it was, in those days while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on the king. Now, that's not unusual in and of itself. Whether it's kings or dictators or presidents or governors or whomever, it's not that unlikely that someone is going to become angry with the leader because of a decision that was made or something that was done. That's usually typical. There is no one person who's ever lived that's had 100% approval rating at any point. Now, there's those who've had high approval ratings where many people have liked them, but not one of us has hit 100% yet. And we see that for Xerxes, that holds true. They seek to lay hands on the king. They are seeking to kill him. The plot, however, became known to Mordecai. And he tells Queen Esther, and Esther informs the king in Mordecai's name. When the plot was investigated and found to be true, they both were hanged on a gallows and is written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So here we have a small-time plot by two lower-level guys who guards the door. They're angry with the king. They're plotting to take his life. Mordecai finds out about it, and he tells the queen. Now, Mordecai's in a good spot. He has someone he can go and tell, and he tells the queen. She tells the king. They investigate it, and the investigation points out or turns out to be, yes, this is true. The king's enemies are deposed, and Mordecai is basically a hero. And it's written, this account is written in the book of the Chronicles of the king, in the king's presence. He sees and knows what's going on, and it's written there. And as we'll see later, typically for those who does the king a favor of this magnitude is usually given some sort of reward, monetarily or otherwise. But for now, it's just passing through. Chapter 3, we're introduced to another person. After these events, King Ahasuerus, promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. Now, it was typical for kings to give authority to those that were underneath them to oversee certain things. As with any major company or corporation, usually the owner will insert managers to oversee the operations of what's going on, managers and assistant managers, and things of that nature to ensure things go smoothly. The delegation of authority is such an important thing, whether it's in business or in politics, things of that nature, when you are able to delegate authority and delegate it to those who are able to do the jobs correctly is so important. And here we see Ahasuerus in the act of doing so, of doing this. And Ahasuerus is doing this. He's given this authority to Haman over all the princes and rulers who were there with him. He's to oversee them. He's the acting manager. And he has some authority, has to have authority to do this. And we see that in verse 2, all the king's servants were at the king's gate, bowed down and paid homage to Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Now it was commanded by the king for all the servants to bow down and pay homage to Haman. They all did, except for Mordecai. Again, here's that question one more time. Why? You would think the king's commanded it. We're to obey our governing authorities, right? Why is Mordecai not bowing down to Haman? Well, that's the question verse 3 the king's servants had. They asked Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? It was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. Ding, here's the answer, he's a Jew. Some of you may be asking, well, what does being a Jew have to do with it? Go back to Exodus 20. The Israelites have been brought out of Egypt. Moses has gone to the mountaintop. He's come down with 2 stone tablets and 10 commands written on them. We remember the first couple ones, right? For I am the Lord your God. You shall not have any other gods before me. You shall not have idols of graven images. They, being the Jews, were not to put anything or anybody else before God. God demanded first place. Not second place, not top 5, not top 10, not a pretty good season. First place. I insert this next. It's semi-humorous, but it proves the point. I was at a devotional a little while back, weekly, usually on Thursdays. We have a devotional at the local nursing home for several of the residents there. the one to devotional. This particular time, he started with a question. He specifically asked two of the ones that were there with us who were a little bit older, that had lived a few years. And he said, I'm going to give you a few minutes to think about this, but the question is this. The question is, I never thought I would live long enough to see fill in the blank. Well, he begins the devotional, he comes back to that question, and one of the gentlemen gave something that made me think a little bit more than maybe it was intended. But he says, I never thought I would live long enough to see a football team play 15 ball games, win 14 of them, and the entire fan base be completely and totally unhappy. He was referring to, of course, the University of Alabama football team. And for those of you, I'm old enough to remember some times that were not so good, 1997 and 2007 specifically, when if we got 6 wins and went to a bowl game, that's great. And yet, over the last decade, it's got to the point where a 14-1 record and a second-place finish, ugh, it just didn't feel right. And that's crazy, right? 14-1 in second place, that's not good enough. There's 129 other teams that would have said, hey, that's good enough for us. That would have been great. But not fans of a school that's got used to being first place. And that's not as serious as what we're talking about here, but yet God, he's not looking for 14-1 in second place. God demands first. We see Jesus echoing that in Matthew 6. He understands that we as people, we get anxious about stuff. We worry about stuff. We tend to be anxious and worry. Why? We don't see the whole picture. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, next month, next year. We don't see down the road. God does, however. And he explains there in chapter 6, Jesus does. He explains that if God so takes care of the birds of the air, ensuring that they are fed and taken care of, and that the grass of the field is so clothed that they are, how much more valuable are you who's made in God's image to him? Of course, we're much more valuable. If God will take care of grass of the field and birds of the air, he's going to take care of us. So he says, verse 33, seek first the kingdom of God. Not second, not later, not maybe tomorrow. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and these things, food, shelter, clothing, these things will be added to you. You'll be provided for. The prodigal son in Luke 15, the lost son, he understood that. It took him hitting rock bottom to understand that concept. You remember him. He demanded his inheritance from his father. The father grants that request, or that demand, actually. Not many days later, he takes up what's his. He leaves. He wastes his living. Many of you understand that it's far easier and quicker to spend money than it is to make it. This young man learned that the hard way. As quickly as it came in, it went out much quicker. Not only when he became broke, when he had spent everything, there was a famine in the land. Not only is he broke, now he can't go to work. Or not find good work anyway. Usually when you're lacking money, your grandmother will probably tell you, well, now's a good time to get to work. Well, for him, it's not going to be that easy. He does find a citizen who hires him out to feed pigs. And as a Jew, that had to be, that there could not be a bigger setback than having to go feed pigs. And it's admitted of him that he would have gladly ate the pig food. He was that hungry and that desperate. It's there he realizes, wait a minute. In my father's house, his employees have more than enough food, and here I am starving. Sometimes it takes us hitting rock bottom to realize who we need to rely on. God takes care of us. Here he's taking care of Esther, and here Mordecai realizes that as powerful as the king is, as much as the king possesses, which in earthly physical terms, this king is wealthy and he is powerful, Mordecai realized and understood, it's not the king who provides, it's God. So he's not going to bow down to Haman. He refuses because he's a Jew. His number one priority is God. So when Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, chapter 3 and verse 5, Haman was filled with rage. We've all heard the word ego, right? There's some people whose ego is, we would say, normal. There's other people whose ego is so big, it, you know, probably the earth can't hardly hold it. It's so big. Oh, Haman has a big ego. He has a huge ego. And we're going to see it's going to be his undoing. He disdained to lay his hand on Mordecai alone. They had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. It wasn't going to be good enough for Haman just to kill or destroy Mordecai. It's not going to be enough. He doesn't want to just take out Haman, take out Mordecai. Who's the one doing the disrespectful thing to him? No, that's not good enough. I don't want to take him out. I want to take them all out. That's the level of his ego. That's the level of his anger. We see that Haman going on in the first month. He gets down to the last month. Haman said to the king of Ahasuerus, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed throughout the peoples of all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries." The king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, verse 11, "The silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please." What Haman said here is technically true. The Jews did have different laws than everybody else. The Jews did do things differently. Unlike all the surrounding people who were at best polytheists, they believed in many gods and were idol worshippers, they believed in one and only served one. For those who served many gods and served idols, what's worshiping one more? You already served many of them, why not add just one more? That's not that much of a step up, to say the least. It's not that big of a deal, but when you only serve one, to add one more is a huge deal. It is a big deal. And for those who profess themselves to be people of God, they will only follow the one true God. And so as Haman is saying this to the king, what he's saying is technically true, but the way he presents it makes it seem as if these people, the Jews, are political adversaries in waiting. Now, they may not overthrow the king and the government per se, but they're going to be a thorn in your flesh. They need to be gotten rid of. They need to be killed off. The king says, you get after it and you do it. And so he does. We see from verses 12 and following in verse 3, he gets the people together. He gets a copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province, is published to all the people, so that they should be ready for the day of the cleansing of the Jews, so to speak. The couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink to see if Susa was in confusion. Now, we see that Mordecai learns of this in chapter 4, verse 1. He rips his clothing, he tears his clothing, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. We understand that as this went out, the Jews understood what was about to happen. This is not a situation of them facing simply a wave of persecution. They're facing extermination. They're facing imminent death. Each and every one of them. Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. I love that phrase, writhed in great anguish. The New American Standard renders it as such. Writhing in great anguish. Why is she doing that? She's Jewish too. It's her death that is now imminent. It's not some radical political faction that's about to be wiped out. It's her people, her included. Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend to her, ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was so. He goes out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa. for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and plead with him for her people. A simple request. He gives Queen Esther what she needs. She's learning of the destruction of her people. She wants to know the details. Why is this happening? Why exactly is it going on? For what purpose? And she sends out a unit to gather the information from Mordecai. Mordecai gives her all the information she asked for. And he informs her that she gives her the order to go into the king to implore his favor. There is one person that can stop this and one person only, and that's the king. And he has her to go in and implore the king. So he goes back to Esther with what Mordecai has given to him. And Esther spoke to the eunuch and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. Verse 11 is important. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king in the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. Esther has a problem. She's facing death on two sides. An edict has been issued and signed by the king that all Jews were to be exterminated. The only way out is to go to the king and reason with him. But she understands if she approaches the king in the inner court when she has not been summoned, that too is death. Unless by some reason of mercy, the king extends his scepter to her. That's the only way she doesn't face death. So, really, the odds of her facing death are quite large. But she says this to the eunuch to give to Mordecai with the idea that, you know, they don't know I'm Jew. I'm a Jew. They don't know she's Jewish. Therefore, it might be possible if she doesn't reveal her background that somehow she could escape death. Simply because they don't know she's Jewish. And besides, if she goes to the king, he'll have her killed because he hasn't summoned her. Matter of fact, she says he hasn't summoned her for 30 days, for a full month. So if he hasn't summoned me in for a month, what makes it think it's okay for me just to waltz on in? Mordecai replies, tells him to reply to Esther. And this right here, I guess if you want to call it anything, this is your go-home line from the book of Esther. He says, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the rest of the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." He lets her know that just because you're the queen doesn't mean you're completely safe. You remember Vashti a couple chapters ago? She refused to be paraded around as an object of beauty, and she's deposed on the spot. If the king acts that way towards towards the original queen, how is he going to treat her when he finds out she's a Jew and Jews are supposed to be dead? That's not going to save you. Don't think you're safe simply because you're in the king's house. That it by itself is not going to be your saving grace. And how often do we as people that we assume simply because we live in a particular place or because we have a particular person as a relative or any such thing of a material or physical nature, we assume that makes us safe. We must realize, as Jesus was pointing out in Matthew 6, the best he could, that our reliance should never be on things that are physical but on God above. He tells her that if she remains silent, relief and deliverance for the Jews will come from somewhere else. God takes care of his people. God provides relief. And what's heartbreaking to me is that how the book of Revelation has been so muddled with such fanciful teaching. And really, that book is a beautiful book. When we read the first three chapters, we realize that's God sending his message by John to the seven churches in Asia who are facing such persecution that we could not wrap our mind around. And the message is, God hears you. You have cried out to him. time and again, and He has heard you. Judgment was coming. Be faithful to death and you receive a crown of life. Specifically to the church at Smyrna, now Revelation 2 and verse 10, we know that. We've heard that many times, to be faithful. That their suffering was not in vain. That relief was coming. That relief would come from God. And here, Mordecai reminds Esther, yes, relief is coming one way or another for God's people. God hears His people. Even in the midst of trial and temptation and persecution, God hears. And God knows. Last few funerals I've done, over the last few months, I've used this. When we think of the shortest verse of the Bible, of course, we immediately go to John 11:35, Jesus wept. But a lot of times we miss the context of what was going on there. Jesus knew Lazarus was going to die before Lazarus got sick. He knew Lazarus was dead before Lazarus died. When He got to Bethany, He knew Lazarus had already been in the grave for 4 days. And yet, when He sees Mary and Martha and those gathered there crying and weeping, what did He do? Knowing full well what He was going to do just moments later, that He was going to have Lazarus come out of the grave, He wept. We have a Savior who understands when we grieve and when we suffer. And Mordecai here reminds his cousin, his daughter Esther, however, whatever usage you want to use there, that relief is coming. Some way, somehow, for God's people. If it's not going to be through you, it's coming from somewhere else. And you and your father's house will be forgotten and wiped out. And he says, who knows whether you have not obtained royalty for such a time as this? You've gone from the bottom of the societal ladder, so to speak, probably the level below, and you have risen to royalty. Hollywood couldn't come up with a better script than this. Poor orphan girl becomes queen. Matter of fact, I think that's probably been written quite a few times. I'm just not a big princess, fairy tale type person to watch those type of things, but I'm pretty sure it's probably been there a few times. But yet here she is, going from dirt, poor rock bottom, going all the way to the top. And Mordecai says, who knows whether you've attained royalty for such a time as this, to save your people. This is why you're here. God has put you here for this reason. To save your people, to save His people. And I love Esther's reply in verse 15. It actually beginning with verse 16. It says, go and assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, not a day. I and my maidens who also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. And Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him for 3 days. They were fasting by all the Jews. Esther, Mordecai, every Jew that could be found in Susa. Pray for me, fast for her and pray for her. That's the idea of biblical fasting. Is to put off physical convenience in order to spend time in prayer. And she says, I'll go into the king. It's not according to the law. We remember Peter and John in Acts 3. We would rather obey God than man. She said, I'll go to the king. It's not according to the law, but I'll go into the king. And if I die, I die. This is what she was brought here to do. Came about on the third day that Esther put her on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther the queen sitting in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be given to you. She has found favor in the king's sight. God indeed to hear has blessed her. Not only does He allow her to come in, He sees that something's troubling her. Now typically if we have any sense whatsoever, if something is troubling someone enough, you can probably see it on their face and in their body language. Especially if you know them quite well. Seems the king knew Esther well enough to know that something was bothering her. And he was willing to give her up to half the kingdom. Whatever it was, help make it better. He's prepared to give her that much. If it pleases the king, she says, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I prepared for them. The king said, bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman come to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Now, at this point in time, Haman had made a request to the king earlier. It's been granted to him to carry it out. In his anger and hatred of not just Mordecai, but all the Jews, he's able to convince the king to allow him, at the expense of 10,000 talents of silver, to ensure the Jews were completely wiped out, of which the queen is one. He doesn't know that yet. And now, there is a banquet that is put on by the king and queen, and he is the sole guest. For a guy who already has a big ego, that ego just has gotten just huge. It's just grown larger. Because how amazing would it be, think of yourself specifically, if the president and first lady invites you to supper and it's just you three. How amazing would that be? And what would that do for your ego? I know what it would do for just about every one of us. Wow. No matter who the president would be, just to be invited to eat with the president and his wife, the first lady, that's an amazing thing to have. And here's Haman. He has to be, he has to be just thinking that life cannot get better. Esther replies, my position, my request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I prepared to them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says. Haman goes out that day glad and pleased of heart. He's glad and pleased. That has been put off to tomorrow. They meet. They're going to do a banquet tomorrow. He's happy. Glad and pleased. He goes out. He sees Mordecai, and he's filled with anger again. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house, sent for his friends and his wife. Now, on one hand, he's on cloud nine. I get to meet with the king and queen. Yes, life is grand. He then sees his adversary, or his perceived adversary, Mordecai, and he gets angry. Now, here's where his attitude and his actions are off. It would be, for us getting an invitation to sit down with the president, to talk with him, to make any concerns we would have known to him, to discuss things that might be on our minds and on our hearts, to discuss things with him privately one-on-one. How amazing would that be to have that opportunity? Imagine that ability to do that. Imagine coming into a large amount of money. Not just hundreds of thousands, but millions, tens of millions. How would that make you feel? To be financially independent, that's about what we're looking at here. And yet, as he leaves the palace, he sees Mordecai, and he's mad. This guy has everything going for him, Haman does. And yet, he can't let go of the bitterness, jealousy, and hatred that he has for Mordecai. So much so, he goes home, he calls his friends, he calls his wife, and he gripes to them that, I saw Mordecai today. Oh my goodness. Things are horrible. That was his mindset. You've just been invited to a banquet with the king and queen. And all you can do is gripe. I don't care who the president would be. If I'm invited to eat with the president and first lady, the first thing I'm telling my wife and friends is, not that I saw someone that I didn't like, it's, guess what I get to do tomorrow? That's the first thing out of my mouth. Not Haman. We see his wife and all his friends in verse 14 chapter 5. They advise him to have a gallows 50 cubits high made in the morning, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it, and then go joyful the king into the banquet. That advice please Haman. 50 cubits. I should have done my math ahead of time, but thankfully I have a calculator right here beside me. A cubit would be 18 inches. So 50 cubits by 18 inches, that's 900 inches. There's 12 inches in a foot. That's 75 feet tall. Folks, that's a large gallows. That's quite large. 75 feet. If you're going to hang someone from that, they're definitely going to hang. So during the night, the king could not sleep. He gave order to bring the book of the records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Remember, back in chapter 2, I believe. That little situation, Mordecai basically saves the king. So he can't sleep this night. He has that read. And they come across the report about the two doorkeepers trying to have the king killed, and Mordecai has that stopped. And verse 3, the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed upon Mordecai for this?" King's servants who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Then the king asked, "Who's in the court?" Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows for which he had prepared for him. The king's servant said to him, "Behold, Haman is sitting in the court." So he has him come in. Haman goes into the king. "What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" Haman assumes it's himself. Oh, he's got a big opinion of himself. Haman says, "It's obvious he's talking about me. Yes, he wants to honor me. Let me think of what I would have done. For the man whom the king desires to honor," verse 7 of chapter 6, "let them bring a royal robe which the king has wore, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, or the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback to the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" The king says to Haman, "Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate, and do not fall short in anything of what you have said." Oh my goodness. Tables have turned. Haman has thought, "Wow, he's gonna honor me, so I want a king's robe on that the king has wore, the king's crown, I want the king's horse." Yeah, he's dreaming big, folks. You know the old saying, "Go big or go home," folks? He's going large. He's not going big, he's going extra large. So he names off this thing, the king says, "Good idea. Get those things that you have mentioned. Don't fall short in anything. Get all those things and get it out to Mordecai the Jew." Oh, why was Haman there to begin with? Oh, that's right. He hated Mordecai and wanted to hang him on a 75-foot gallows. Wow. Talk about a turn of events. Like the orphan girl who becomes queen, Haman finds himself in quite a predicament. And now he goes home while with his head hanging low. And we see in chapter 7, our time is indeed running short with a few minutes left. The king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther, the queen, and the king said to Esther on the second day also as they drank their wine at the banquet, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done." Chapter 7, verse 3, Queen Esther replied, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I will remain silent. For the trouble would not be commiserate with the annoyance of the king." King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus?" Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman." Uh-oh. It got bad the day before. And if it could get worse, here it is. Have there been times in your life where your day has gone so terribly that you uttered the famous words, "Could it get any worse?" It can. For Haman, it just did. And it's about to get even more worse if there's ever such a thing. So not only is he getting with the king and queen, that was a good thing yesterday, but today he's been added as a foe and adversary. And there cannot be a worse feeling than be sitting with the king and queen and to be told that he is the enemy. Haman becomes terrified. The king arose in his anger from drinking and went into the palace garden. Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden to the palace, or into the place where they were drinking, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. The king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. He was outed as a foe and an adversary of the king. Now, his punishment has been made that he should hang from the very gallows that he made for his enemy. The twist and the turns. And yet, I know that's verse 7. We got a couple more chapters that could be covered. But we see here that for Esther, coming up from where she was, such a disadvantaged state of being that none of it was of her own doing. Her parents being dead, we presume she's being raised by a cousin as her closest relative. And yet as a young lady, as a young woman, she arises through basically no effort of her own to becoming royalty. You may say that's a fairy tale story in a way that could be true, but yet in this situation, it was God's grace being given not just to Esther, but through Esther to her people. We must understand, we don't see the big picture many times. There was no way Esther could know the day she was picked to be queen that God already knew there was coming a situation where she would be needed. And God put her there knowing that she was going to face certain death. And he needed someone there who was mature enough, who would be able and strong enough to be able to make the decision she made. God put Esther there. This was a girl he knew and was well acquainted with grief and adversity throughout her whole life. She understood more than many people her age the importance and the priority of the things as they should be, the priority of the things that should be in our lives. She understood those things. Now, when her and Mordecai, through a messenger, through a eunuch, he was taking messages back and forth, when she's informed of Mordecai that she's going to have to go see the king, she's got to implore the king, that's the only option they really have, or else they're all going to die, she says, well, if I go to the king and he hasn't bidden me come in, that's certain death for me. And really and truly, if she says nothing, and the king finds out, it's certain death. If she goes and says something, it's almost certain death. She's facing death no matter what, physical death. When Mordecai reminds her that, look, just because you're in the king's house doesn't mean you're safe. Vashti got deposed for something very minor. Simply because you're in the king's house doesn't mean you're safe. Deliverance will come from somewhere else. This is your time to step up. And who knows if this has not been the reason why you were put here. Folks, there's times in our lives where we find ourselves in situations where, like Esther, we're going to have to make tough decisions. It may not be near as tough as what she had to deal with. But she had to deal with the decision with maturity, with courage that many of us most likely would not understand. And yet, as Christians, we understand the society and the world we live in now by simply stating verbally through social media, through whatever means, that I'm a Christian and I believe in Jesus is almost asking for instant ridicule. It's asking for almost instant persecution. And yet, we must have the courage to, if nothing else, simply say, I am a Christian. Not because I believe I'm perfect, because none of us are. As Paul wrote to the Romans, we all sin and come short. We simply believe Christ because we understand that to be the best option. It makes the most sense. Folks, Christianity is not simply, for lack of a better phrase, a wing and a prayer. It's logical. It makes sense. And we understand that this world did not happen by accident. Because folks, if this whole creation, from the very big to the very minute, if all this was just a cosmic accident, folks, we have no purpose and we have zero value. But when we understand Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, we realize that we have purpose. When someone or something is created, it has value and it has purpose. And folks, we're made not just created out of an imagination, where you're created in the image and likeness of God, male and female alike. And yes, as silly as it may sound, as powerful as God is, remember, He created the entire universe in 6 days with nothing more than the sound of His voice. And yet it takes courage to say, I believe Him, and I will follow Him, because He created me. And the fact that He sees value in me, so much value in each one of us, that we have John 3:16. As Paul tried to explain to the Romans, I'll say this in closing. There's very few people we would exchange our own life for, meaning to let them live, we would die. That's a very short list. You know what a shorter list is? That shorter list of how many people we would let them live by letting our child die in their stead. For us as humans, that list is probably non-existent. But for God, He so loved. He gave His Son to die for us, and that for those who would believe in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. That's the value we have in God. Let us have the courage and conviction to love Him back as we live. I love the book of Esther. I didn't think I'd go the full hour, but here we are. Wow, all right. There's a lot there. Rebecca said she'd give me a signal if I started talking too fast, and I may have overlooked it, but I didn't see it tonight. So thank y'all so much for your attention, for allowing me to be here. Hopefully I will not be summoned to do such a long lesson again, but I appreciate y'all having me here, and hopefully I won't have to put you through that one more time. But I'm just going to close this in a quick word of prayer, and I'll turn everything back over to JP. Heavenly Father, we thank You for this day that You've given us. We thank You for blessing us and caring for us and loving us enough to provide for us and giving us Your only Son. And Father, may we always look to go forth and live courageously for you each and every day that we have. May we always seek You for all things. Forgive us when we fail You, in Jesus' name. Amen. Again, thank you.